Norms mandated that women travel with a chaperone, such as a family member or a friend, especially if their travels took them far from home. Young women who traveled by themselves were most likely running from someone or something. Captain Bowles turned a blind eye to the unusual passenger. He was a man who had traveled the Atlantic and had met many people, and while he might not have known that the young traveler was the president's slave, he could tell that Ona Judge had a reason for wanting to leave the city. Fortunately for Judge, Bowles either didn't care about the young woman's past, or was perhaps sympathetic to the plight of black slaves. Grateful for the shipmaster's acceptance, Judge quietly boarded his ship, beginning her life anew, now as a fugitive. 9. Slavery and Freedom in New Hampshire. The crashing waves of the Atlantic Ocean hurled saddles and candles from one side of the storage hold to another. The smell of molasses and coffee was thick, nauseating passengers who were unaccustomed to sailing with Bowles on his frequent trips between Philadelphia, New York, and Portsmouth. Transportation in the 18th century was never easy, and traveling by sea could be dangerous. Old and poorly inspected ships slipped in and out of cities with torn sails and weathered caulking, hoping to make it to the next port without incident. Ona Judge had never before sailed on such a ship, a single-masted sloop that could carry up to 75 people, depending on the size of the cargo. These vessels were designed to haul freight from one coastal town to the next. But ship captains, like Bowles, earned extra money by allowing passengers to ride along. Any seafaring voyages that Judge might have taken with the Washingtons would have been close to enjoyable. Short river crossings in relatively luxurious vessels were what Judge had come to know, but she had turned her back on all of it. Now on board the Nancy, space was minimal, and travelers lodged themselves wherever there was room. Once again, the fugitive found herself sleeping in tight quarters, but this time it was with strangers. Some were traveling home to visit with family and friends, and others who, like Judge, were leaving behind a difficult past for the possibilities of a new future in Portsmouth. The unsettled sea likely forced Judge's stomach to turn somersaults, sending her to look for refuge from her nausea above deck. The wind could cool her flushed and sweaty forehead, offering temporary relief from seasickness. Surely other passengers suffered the same way, hanging their bodies over the sides of the sloop, releasing the contents of their stomach into the Atlantic. Every morning when the sun lifted itself above the horizon, Judge would have looked out across the ocean, thankful to have survived another day away from her owners. But still, she was terrified. For 5 days, Judge contained her fear. She could not appear too nervous, as passengers were already throwing quick and curious glances toward the light-skinned black woman who traveled alone. She knew that the Washingtons were looking for her, and that by now her name and a bounty probably appeared in many of the Philadelphia newspapers. She wondered how much of a reward was attached to her recapture, a thought that sent her eyes to scan the strangers on board. Surely none of Washington's agents had made it to Bowles's ship before it left Dock Street, but she wouldn't know this for certain until the Nancy reached New Hampshire. The beautiful and expensive clothing that she wore to serve the Washingtons was packed away, and instead, Judge would have dressed in inconspicuous clothing, allowing her to hide in plain sight. She was a hunted woman and would try to pass, not for white, but as a free black northern woman. During her 5-day journey, Judge reviewed her arrival plans over and over again. Her Philadelphia friends had not shared with her the ship's destination or any other details about her journey until Judge was about to set sail. This kind of discretion was necessary to protect the fugitive and all those who helped in her escape. But the lack of information and the not knowing must have fueled her anxiety. Before she departed Philadelphia, she was likely told who would help her once she arrived in Portsmouth and given a description of a chaperone who would meet her near the docks and lead her to relative safety. Everything that Judge knew about her future in New Hampshire was conveyed to her in haste. Even if Judge had been literate and able to write down her instructions, she would have been warned against doing so. Her Philadelphia friends surely demanded that the escape plan be committed to memory, with no existing documentation that could tie her to the free black community. Judge had a lot to think about during her time at sea, most likely worrying about the basics in life, such as food, shelter, and safety. How would she take care of herself once she arrived in her new city? And could she remain hidden for the rest of her life? She knew that it was just a matter of time before her owners sent slave catchers to look for her. Judge would have wondered if Portsmouth was far enough away from the Washingtons to ever allow her peace of mind, and perhaps she second-guessed her decision to run away. But there was no turning back. Weak from a difficult journey and filled with fear, Judge nevertheless placed one foot in front of another and disembarked. Perhaps she offered her thanks to John Bowles, but more likely, she quickly left the wharf just in case there were slave catchers on the prowl. Ona Judge's friends in Philadelphia must have thought that Portsmouth would be a relatively safe location for her to live in anonymity. Although the black population was small, the hope was that Judge could find a way to secretly integrate into a new community more than 300 miles away from Philadelphia. Portsmouth was unlike any place Ona Judge had ever lived. Different from the bustling environs of a Philadelphia or a New York, Portsmouth was a growing port city with a developing 18th century shipping industry. But compared to Philadelphia, the city was tiny, counting close to 5,000 residents. Judge was accustomed to moving, making new friends, and learning the new sights and smells of a city. But this was the first time that Judge moved without the comfort of family or friends. She didn't have the reliability of her older brother, nor did she have the advice of the enslaved Moll to help direct her. Judge didn't know a soul in Portsmouth. She was completely alone. It wouldn't take long for Judge to realize the differences between Portsmouth and Philadelphia. But one of the most startling contrasts was that her new city counted very few black people. At the time of Judge's arrival, there were fewer than 800 black men and women living in New Hampshire, and fewer than 200 of them were enslaved. Similar to the rest of New England, 3 out of every 4 citizens who lived there at the end of the 18th century were of English, Scottish, or Irish ancestry. Judge's new community of black men and women in Portsmouth never climbed above 2 or 3% of the population, and the majority of them lived and worked along the sea and the rivers. It wouldn't take long for Judge to become acquainted with her new community. There were fewer black people in the entire city of Portsmouth than there were slaves living at Mount Vernon. Judge's first priority was to find a place to live, no easy task for a single black woman with limited resources. Once again, she would have to rely on a network of free blacks, this time in Portsmouth. They undoubtedly were prepared for the fugitive's arrival, directing Judge to her new temporary home where she lodged at a free Negro's. Free blacks in Portsmouth were accustomed to helping fugitive slaves. With the question of temporary housing settled, Judge set about to find work. She would need to locate an employment opportunity quickly, one that would allow her to support herself. Grateful for the roof over her head, Judge would have wanted to prove to her hosts that she was ambitious and determined to be independent. If she took too long locating employment, her hosts might tire of her, or worse, feel resentful. Judge was a superior seamstress and was capable of making the most beautiful clothing, as she had done for the Washingtons. But this kind of work would be hard for a fugitive to find. She had no references and no sample work. Domestic labor was the only opportunity that Judge had to carve out a meager living, and she grabbed it, quickly finding a position in a local home. Most black women, no matter their station as enslaved or free, engaged in backbreaking domestic labor that proved cruel to the human body. They toiled in the homes of New England's white residents, cooking, cleaning, and tending to the personal needs of their employers. Although Judge was accustomed to being on call in a domestic capacity for Martha Washington, she did not do the heaviest and most physically taxing labor required in an 18th century home. The Washingtons' large staff allowed for white servants and male slaves to provide assistance with difficult domestic chores, freeing Judge to tend to the delicate and intimate needs of her owner. In New Hampshire, she could not be so selective. Black domestics scrubbed floors, washed laundry, cooked meals, and cleaned the homes of their employers, difficult chores in the snowy winters of New England. Judge and other women, both black and white, tore muscles and broke bones as they strained to carry large loads of laundry, assisted in the fields of rural New Hampshire, and toted heavy cauldrons of water for meal preparation and bathing. Arguably, one of the most physically taxing responsibilities of a domestic was the preparation of the wash. Enslaved and freed domestics began their days carrying 10 and 20 gallon containers of water from the pump back to the home. It could take upward of 100 gallons of water per day to complete all the washing and cooking required for a single family. This necessity could send black women to and from the pump up to 5 times per day. Arm strength alone was not sufficient, prompting black women to reach back to their ancestral traditions. Black domestics often carried large containers of water upon their heads, an age-old method used in Africa, but one that could lead to curved spines and skull fractures. More than taxing, icy and snow-covered footpaths could make the difficult task of water retrieval a dangerous journey. In addition to water retrieval, domestics and laundresses also built the fire necessary for washing, bending their backs over hot wooden tubs for hours at a time. Before the washing process began, Judge and other domestics would have made soap by hand from lye and animal fat, using wood ashes, dung, or hemlock to remove stains. Once the water was collected and brought to the house, the arduous labor of washing the clothes began. Judge stirred the clothes in boiling water and then had to wring each article of clothing or linen by hand and hang them to dry. After thorough drying, clothing and bed linens would need to be ironed, another time-consuming and often dangerous and terribly hot task. Food preparation also required countless hours of dedicated work and consumed much of the day. Ona Judge had never been charged with feeding her owners or herself. Hercules and a kitchen staff prepared each meal for the first family and their slaves and servants. Judge would now have to learn how to cook, and to cook well. Surely she had watched the slaves at Mount Vernon make hoe cakes and prepare fish stew, but there was a difference between watching and doing. Her new black friends in Portsmouth would have provided recipes and culinary tips suitable to northern palates. Presenting as a bad cook could earn any domestic a swift dismissal. Black domestics, both enslaved and free, would rise early in the morning to prepare the breakfast meal. The kneading of dough and the baking of bread, in addition to the plucking of chickens and cutting of vegetables, prompted early signs of arthritis in the fingers and hands of domestics. Torn and fatigued muscles received little care, as enslaved women and live-in domestics were often allotted living spaces in the coldest and least insulated locations of the household. Forced to sleep in cellars or attics, Slaves were contained in the most out-of-the-way spaces. Attics contained very little to no ventilation, promising unbearably cold conditions in the winter and stifling heat during the summers. The conditions of slavery and servitude wore on the black female body, ensuring that the majority of black women in New England did not live beyond the age of 40. Yet Judge had few choices but to become a domestic and a laundress, choosing to endure physically punishing work in New Hampshire, rather than accept her life as a slave. That Judge elected to become a domestic, that she chose to endure physically punishing work in New Hampshire rather than remain a slave, says everything we need to know about how much she valued freedom. Human bondage had existed in New England for more than 150 years. African slavery was first legalized in Massachusetts in 1641, unleashing the traffic in human souls to spread quickly throughout the rest of the northern colonies. Black men and women lived and worked in the seaport of Portsmouth as early as 1645, when the earliest known African first arrived. Slave trader Captain Smith arrived in New England with a handful of bound laborers who had survived the long and horrific Middle Passage. Smith sold one human to a Mr. Williams of Piscataquack. No name or details remain about the captive who arrived in New England. However, he probably spent his life toiling against his will for Mr. Williams in some capacity. New Hampshire watched the town of Portsmouth develop with the assistance of slave labor, and while it didn't grow a cash crop such as tobacco or rice, it had its own list of hazards for Africans. The journey to New England was long, forcing Africans to endure the inconceivable atrocities of the Middle Passage beyond the shores of West Africa or the islands of the Caribbean. Many perished before stepping foot onto the New England colonies, a reality confronted by slave owner William Pepperell of Kittery Point, Maine. In 1719, Pepperell purchased 5 enslaved Africans from the island of Antigua, and only one of his bound laborers, a woman, survived the journey. After only 3 weeks in New England, she too succumbed to illness. The extreme cold and acclimation to life in New England found slave owners like Pepperell in jeopardy of losing a great deal of wealth in the risky business of slave trading. But when Ona Judge arrived in New Hampshire, she encountered a state that was on its way to ending the institution of slavery. Since the Fugitive Slave Act of 1793 allowed slave owners to cross state lines to retrieve their human property, it was important for runaways to find communities that were at the very least rethinking the institution of human bondage. After Judge stepped onto the shores of Portsmouth, she would eventually meet and come to know many, if not all, of the town's black residents, whether free or enslaved. These men and women of Portsmouth cautiously watched the change in state laws that appeared to welcome additional sources of labor. New Hampshire began to wrestle with the issue of slavery in the decade prior to Judge's arrival, joining Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Rhode Island in its reconsideration of human bondage. Although a Bill of Rights promised equality and liberty to the citizens of New Hampshire, slavery continued for decades. A revised tax code of 1789 lifted the hopes of men and women held in bondage, as new wording stated, "Slaves cease to be known and held as property." But the optimism of the enslaved was dashed, as the majority of slave owners in New Hampshire did not move to emancipate their slaves, but instead read the new code as a tax relief that exempted their human bondage as a tax liability. The slow process of gradual emancipation moved in fits and starts across New England. But in Judge's new home of Portsmouth, human bondage disappeared by 1805. Similar to other urban or coastal cities and towns, Portsmouth ended its relationship with slavery before the rest of the state. While slave owners in Portsmouth transitioned to a free-wage labor system, the rest of New Hampshire lagged behind. It wouldn't be until 1857 that the New Hampshire legislature took the final step of abolishing slavery altogether. Black men and women privately celebrated the gradual steps of emancipation, but took a cautious and skeptical approach to the promises of freedom, as they still encountered daily indignities, violence, and a lack of citizenship or equal protection under the law. The black community of Portsmouth would pass on local history and information about the law to newcomers like Judge. Just as she had done in New York and Philadelphia, she listened, realizing that the decision to relocate to Portsmouth had been the most strategic of moves. Judge had her Philadelphia friends to thank for that. 10. A close call. Early each morning, Ona Judge would rise from fitful sleep. Her mind refused to give her body the deep slumber that it needed as it revisited the images of her siblings and nieces left behind at Mount Vernon. Awakened by nightmares, Judge would have to train her mind to believe that she was safe from harm. The only cure for what must have been acute insomnia was the body-stiffening domestic labor that threw most black women into almost instant sleep at the end of their evenings. As the days transitioned into weeks and then months, the fugitive fell into the rhythm of domestic work and life. The sun rose early during the summer in New England, a gift to Judge and the other domestics, who depended upon its light for breakfast preparation and early morning chores. Each day, as Judge walked to her new job, one that paid her wages, she would welcome the hard work that lay ahead. The work was difficult, and perhaps, to her mind, demeaning, but it was hard and honest labor that allowed her to survive in Portsmouth. Though she spent the entirety of her day in service, her work required trips to local shops to fetch needed household items. Judge moved about her new city without the surveillance of an owner, and over time grew accustomed to this new freedom. She could visit the marketplace to purchase turnips and striped bass, dinner items that she could present to her hosts as symbols of her deep appreciation. When she received her wages, she might even be able to surprise them with additional quantities of tea and maybe even sugar. The long days of summer offered the fugitive a bit of extra daylight when she returned home from work. After helping her hosts with their own domestic chores, she could refresh herself on the art of sewing, remembering what an excellent seamstress she had been. Perhaps she would start with something simple, such as a linen shift for the lady of the house. Poor women could afford only one or two of these essential items, which they wore under their clothes every day. It would make a perfectly practical gift for any free black woman struggling to survive in New Hampshire. If Judge could save enough from her modest wages, she could purchase material, ribbons, and buttons, allowing her to create sample clothing for the residents of Portsmouth to examine. Over time, she might be able to earn a reputation as an esteemed seamstress, earning enough money to leave the domestic work and laundering behind. The skills that she perfected back at Mount Vernon and in the executive mansion might allow her to find a way out from underneath crippling poverty. Judge knew that in order for this to be a possibility, she would have to be patient, work hard, and save her money, all the while, and most importantly, remain undetected in her new city. While her walks about town were a reminder of her newfound freedom, they were always accompanied by the concerns of recapture. Judge never forgot that she was a hunted woman. Ever vigilant and alert, she knew she'd be a fool to dawdle in the narrow streets of her new city, for she might be asked to present freedom papers. Black men and women needed to walk with purpose in Portsmouth, lest they be questioned about their business, attracting unwanted or perhaps hostile attention from their white neighbors. Evening curfews were strictly enforced for Portsmouth's black residents, and Judge would have made it a priority to be safely indoors and away from prying eyes and officials with invasive questions before nightfall. In the streets, allies could be hard to distinguish from enemies, and in many ways, the family that could harm her the most was also the most prominent family in New Hampshire, the Langdon family. Senator Langdon and his family were probably the most respected family in New Hampshire and close friends of the Washingtons. A native of Portsmouth, John Langdon was born in 1741, and unlike many young men of his class, he bypassed an elite education and opted for a lucrative career in trade. Quickly learning the Atlantic trade routes, Langdon became a successful ship captain, transporting and selling goods, and eventually purchasing his own vessels. It was only thanks to the restrictions of British trade policies that Langdon found himself thrust into the politics of the American Revolutionary era. Langdon led a successful charge against a British military installation, cementing his position as a Revolutionary War hero and political leader in New Hampshire. Serving as a delegate to the Second Continental Congress, Speaker of the New Hampshire House of Representatives, and a delegate to the Constitutional Convention, John Langdon became one of the most powerful men in the nation, eventually elected the first president of the United States Senate, the most powerful position in the country, until George Washington was elected to the presidency. It was Langdon who sent word to Mount Vernon via messenger that Washington was the unanimous choice to lead the nation. After the election of George Washington, Langdon continued his political career, serving as a senator and a governor of New Hampshire. Langdon met and worked with George Washington on many occasions. In November of 1789, Washington described a visit to New Hampshire in his diary, writing, "Portsmouth, it is said, contains about 5,000 inhabitants. There are some good houses, among which Colonel Langdon's may be esteemed the first." Washington did not stay with Langdon in his home. The president preferred to stay in nearby inns, never wanting to impose upon his friends and political acquaintances. But he did enjoy tea in the Langdon parlor and shared a few meals with the Langdon family during the trip. The senator and his wife Elizabeth Sherburne Langdon, often referred to as Betsy, had two children, Elizabeth and John, who died as an infant. As the Langdons became friendly with the Washingtons, Elizabeth developed a friendship with the president's granddaughter, Nellie. During the 1790s, the two young girls visited one another at the Executive Mansion in Philadelphia. One can imagine them taking long walks and talking incessantly about their lives. Elizabeth and Nellie represented the new version of American royalty, one the daughter of a senator, the other the granddaughter of the President of the United States. Both girls understood the pressures that came along with elevated status, as well as its privileges. Ona Judge watched these two young girls grow up in the spotlight of early American politics. Judge remembered the times in Philadelphia when Moll was overburdened with caring for the Washington grandchildren, and she had stepped in to help. She may well have served the senator's daughter tea, or acted as a chaperone or caregiver for the two young girls. Elizabeth Langdon and Ona Judge knew each other, a liability that the fugitive must have contemplated after she arrived in New Hampshire. Liabilities and all, Judge came to appreciate, if not love, her new city. During the summer months following her escape, Judge carefully explored her surroundings and began piecing together a new life. She carried herself as if she had never been enslaved, an important performance for all fugitives, but one that began to feel more and more natural. That is, until Judge came face to face with her past. As she walked through the narrow streets of Portsmouth, perhaps on an errand or on her way to do a bit of shopping, a familiar sight ignited terror in the fugitive's chest. There, in front of Judge, was the young girl she had served in the Executive Mansion. Elizabeth Langdon, now 18 years old, walked directly toward the frightened fugitive. The moment that Judge had feared had finally come. The speed of her pulse quickened as Judge's eyes focused upon the woman she had gotten to know in Philadelphia. Her first priority would be to flee, to leave the street, and to hope that the senator's daughter had not recognized her freckled face. Judge's stiffened body, newly worn by the tyranny of domestic work, readied itself to run, to bolt from Portsmouth city streets, and to look for refuge. Quaint and intimate, the small streets of her new city presented no safe space for the fugitive to hide. But within a few seconds, she would have realized that running would be the worst possible reaction. If she fled, she would draw attention to herself, something no fugitive could risk. She had only a matter of seconds to figure out what she should do to safeguard her new life. For most of her life as a slave, Ona Judge had to hide her feelings. She was accustomed to erasing anger from a furrowed brow or holding back tears in sorrow-filled eyes. And now, she steadied herself and tucked her fear away. Lowering her head in an attempt to avoid eye contact with her owner's family friend, Judge kept walking. Elizabeth Langdon paused, expecting a cordial greeting from the familiar face, but she received no such acknowledgement. Flashes of enslavement back at Mount Vernon might have quickly pushed their way to the front of Ona Judge's mind. She would have remembered the stories of enslaved people who had unsuccessfully attempted escape back at her Virginia birthplace. Some of these men and women were punished and sold. Her purposeful walk quickened to a trot as the fugitive swiftly dodged the dangerous confrontation. But where could she go? Where would she hide? A return to her new home would have been risky. She couldn't chance being followed by Langdon, as it would put her host family in danger, or place them in a position of being charged with breaking federal laws for harboring a fugitive slave. She'd have to wait until nightfall to try to outwit any would-be captors. When Judge finally returned home, she most likely looked to her hosts for advice and strategy, as any semblance of a normal routine that she had cobbled together over the summer had been destroyed when she came face to face with Elizabeth Langdon. If for some miraculous reason Langdon had not seen her, it was just a matter of time before one of the Washington's friends, or perhaps a family member of Portsmouth native Tobias Lear, discovered her. Elizabeth Langdon rarely took notice of common folk as she walked about Portsmouth. As the senator's daughter, she was accustomed to staring eyes and false pretense situations that could be avoided by offering little to no direct eye contact. But she couldn't stop thinking about the woman she had seen in the street. The face of the young black woman looked hauntingly familiar to Elizabeth. And there was something about those eyes. She was certain that she'd seen them before, but where? And then it dawned on her. The Executive Mansion. But what on earth was Judge doing in Portsmouth? And where was Mrs. Washington? Surely she would have known if the President and his family were in town on official business, or for a quick visit. For a moment, the Senator's daughter second-guessed herself. The only other alternative for the slave woman's presence in Portsmouth was completely unimaginable. Yet, on the off chance that it was Ona Judge, she must alert her father immediately. Once Elizabeth Langdon conferred with her parents, the situation became quite clear. The senator's daughter had spotted the Washington's fugitive. Still in shock, Langdon probably found herself wondering about Judge's escape from her owners. But perhaps more curious to her was Judge's reason for wanting to leave the Washingtons in the first place. For the slaveholding elite, it was difficult to accept the agency of black thought or the desire and risk involved in escape. The Langdons had participated in the buying and selling of slaves from the late 1600s up until the eve of the Revolution. And just like the Washingtons, they considered themselves to be benevolent masters, affording their slaves more than the bare necessities of life. They fashioned themselves as different from those hardened slave owners notorious for the use of the lash and for cruel and demonic torture. In their minds, they had been noble slave owners who provided food and shelter for their slaves, whom they believed to be incapable of caring for themselves. The Langdons would have known that the president offered pocket money to his slaves, allowed them to attend the theater, and even negotiated with them, allowing slaves to keep their families together. In their estimation, he was a good owner, paternalistic, and adhered to the rules of Southern gentility. Why would any of the Washington slaves run away, especially Ona Judge? Hadn't she been treated well, clothed, and fed? What the New Hampshire family could not envision was the suffocation felt by house slaves who controlled very little of their time. Under the constant and watchful eye of her mistress, Judge withstood her teenage years under Martha Washington's scrutiny. She spent most of her days and nights in proximity to the Washington family, and without designated slave quarters, there was no place to breathe, no place to reconnect with friends or family, and no place to release the frustration and depression that came tied to the institution of slavery. Judge chose to take her chances on a risky escape rather than live a life trapped in human bondage, and her fierce insistence upon freedom was almost incomprehensible to most white people, the Langdons included. Even though John Langdon was no longer a slaveholder, he knew what must be done. Not only were the Washingtons family friends, but as a senator of the United States, he was obligated to follow the law. Ona Judge was a fugitive, and the Washingtons were entitled to their property. On August 21st, the Washingtons returned to Philadelphia from their extended visit at Mount Vernon and knew exactly where to find their slave woman. 11. The Negotiator. There were many pressing matters for the president to address during the late summer of 1796, but his decision to step down as president took center stage. Ignoring the fervent wishes of his party members who wanted Washington to remain in office, he was steadfast in his resolve to retire. The president was exhausted and wanted to return to life as a civilian farmer, a simpler life that would not wear on his aging body. He made it very clear that nothing short of a national emergency would change his mind about retirement. Washington was ready to go back to Virginia. With an election fast approaching, the president chose to announce his intentions quickly. His farewell address, created in most part by Alexander Hamilton, was complete, so he sent Tobias Lear to fetch David Claypool, publisher of the Philadelphia newspaper, Claypool's American Daily Advertiser. Washington wanted his farewell address to appear in David Claypool's paper, the same newspaper that 4 months earlier printed an advertisement with a $10 reward for the return of Ona Judge. On September 19th, Washington's farewell address was publicly released in Philadelphia, leaving the American people with the task of selecting a new commander-in-chief. In the midst of planning for retirement, however, the president took up the work of slave catching. Ona Judge had placed her owners in a very difficult situation. The Washingtons were now faced with the politically tricky task of attempting to reclaim a slave in the state of New Hampshire, which was not as committed to African slavery as was their beloved Virginia. They would need to devise a plan to recover her, one that was swift and discreet. The Washingtons were perplexed about Judge's motivations, associates, and her desired destination. For a second time in 1 year, they were feeling their way through a disturbing situation that had caught them off guard. First, their granddaughter Eliza Custis's marriage, and now, in a reversal of roles, Ona Judge was the cause of surprise and uncertainty for the Washingtons. But any confusion that the president possessed had given way to anger. Judge had finally interrupted his slave rotation plan. The president knew that if he pursued the fugitive, even with the law on his side, he might have a public relations problem, a dilemma he had managed to avoid throughout his residency in Philadelphia. Runaways reminded Americans who were sorting out their feelings about human bondage that slaves were people, not simply property. Judge's escape made a new case for a growing number of Northerners who bristled at the thought of African slavery. It mattered not if a slave was well-dressed and offered small tokens of kindness, worked in luxurious settings, or in the blistering heat. Enslavement was never preferable over freedom for any human being, and if given the opportunity, a slave, even the president's slave, preferred freedom. Ona Judge's escape set a bad precedent for the slaves who worked in the executive mansion. As such, Washington was selective about who he brought back to Philadelphia after his trip home to Virginia had come to an end. Only Maul and Joe Richardson had been allowed to return to the Capitol for the president's final year in office. Shaken up by Judge's escape, the Washingtons made do with northern white servants, fearful that the fugitive had started a trend. Immediately after he settled with his new staff, both enslaved and wage-earning, Martha Washington gave the president his marching orders: retrieve Ona. The fugitive belonged to the First Lady, after all, and Judge had already been promised to her granddaughter. The president would need to work quickly to capture the fugitive, or he would have to deal with the displeasure of his wife, not to mention reimburse the Custis estate for the loss of its property. Weighing all of his options carefully and placing discretion above all else, the president decided to enlist the services of the federal government to quietly recapture the fugitive. He approached Secretary of the Treasury Oliver Wolcott, Jr. The secretary must have listened to Washington's request for assistance with his normal deference, and of course, he offered to help the president with his problem. Following their conversation, the next day, the president sat down to write the first of six letters that would change hands between the president and his slave-catching agents. On September 1st, the president began his letter-writing to Wolcott. Several months had passed since Judge's escape, but Washington was still angry, and the more he wrote, the angrier he felt. To his mind, the slave woman had been treated well, more like a family member than a slave. And this was how she repaid her kind masters. And, of course, she couldn't have chosen a more inopportune time. The last thing Washington wanted to deal with during his final months in office was the recapture of a fugitive. He had many more pressing matters to attend, a thought that stirred his anger and commanded his thoughts. Martha Washington's slave, a woman who did her best not to be seen or heard, was now at the forefront of the president's mind. As he sat at his desk, he thought long and hard about Judge, remembering how in 1784, a freckle-faced 10-year-old joined the team of house slaves at the Mansion House. She began her new assignment just as the president returned from the war, perhaps a memory that prompted Washington to realize that both he and Judge had acclimated to a new way of life at the very same time. He thought about the 7 years that Judge had spent with his family in New York and Philadelphia, and how she knew the most intimate details of the Washingtons' lives. His reminiscing added fuel to the fire. As he wrote his lengthy 3-page letter about the fugitive, Judge's face reappeared over and over again in his mind. But oddly enough, Washington never offered a physical description of her. Perhaps he had shared this information during his conversation with Wolcott, but it was more likely that the secretary was familiar with Ona Judge from his frequent visits with the president. And of course, the runaway slave advertisements that appeared in the Philadelphia Gazette could serve as a helpful guide. One strand of hearsay that Washington addressed in his letter was that a male suitor had put Ona Judge up to the business of escape. In Washington's mind, there was no possible way that Judge could or would have engineered her own escape under the watchful eyes of her owners. Someone else must have lured her away and planned her escape. For as Washington wrote to Wolcott, not the least suspicion was entertained of her going or having formed a connection with anyone who could induce her to such an act. Over time, Washington grew adamant that a boyfriend was at the center of Judge's getaway. The president believed that a known acquaintance of the first family, a Frenchman to be exact, was involved in Judge's escape. This man, who Washington never named but suggested was mentally unstable, had not been seen since the fugitive left the president's house. Subsequent conversations with Washington's sources reported that this French boyfriend abandoned Ona Judge, leaving her destitute and dependent upon earning wages as a seamstress and begging for domestic work. Believing that Judge had been beguiled into running away, Washington asked Wolcott to contact Portsmouth's customs officer, Thomas Whipple, which, to his mind, was a completely appropriate request. It was the president's residency in Philadelphia, a matter of state business, that allowed for Judge to take flight in the first place. Therefore, the use of governmental resources in his slave catching was justifiable. Washington believed the customs collector could play a crucial role in recovering his slave woman, serving as the president's eyes and ears on the ground in Portsmouth. The president offered suggestions about recapturing the fugitive, and all of them were clear violations of the law. Washington understood the Fugitive Slave Act of 1793. After all, he had signed the bill. His advice for the customs collector conveniently sidestepped all of the regulations that were in place to appropriately return a runaway to his or her owner. The law stated that anyone who captured a fugitive must bring him or her in front of a judge or magistrate and provide proof of ownership before leaving the state with their human property. The president had no intention of involving judges or magistrates in the handling of this dilemma, but he did suggest that Elizabeth Langdon or her mother could offer a formal identification of the runaway if positive proof was required. Washington hoped that such an identification would be unnecessary, but the appropriate people were in place if needed. Once captured, Whipple should put her on board a vessel bound immediately to this place or to Alexandria, which I should like better. Always cash-strapped, the president believed his suggestions for Judge's recovery would prove the safest and least expensive. For his troubles, Whipple would be compensated for any and all costs associated with the capture and return of his fugitive slave. And of course, the president would be thankful for his assistance. For many who served the young nation in any kind of authoritative role, the appreciation of the president was most welcome. For who wouldn't want to be in the good graces of the President of the United States? Given Washington's stature, one would assume Whipple would have completed the task with enthusiasm. Though Washington closed his letter with an apology to Oliver Wolcott, writing, "I am sorry to give you or anyone else trouble on such a trifling occasion," his annoyance with Ona Judge was evident. The ingratitude of the girl, who was brought up and treated more like a child than a servant, and Mrs. Washington's desire to recover her, ought not to escape with impunity if it can be avoided. His pride, in addition to his wife's anger and strong desire to have her bondwoman back in her possession, moved the president to pursue Judge no matter the law. On behalf of the president, Secretary Wolcott contacted Portsmouth's collector of customs, Joseph Whipple. He responded to Wolcott by letter on September 10th, acknowledging that he would, with great pleasure, execute the president's sick wishes in the matter to which it relates. Joseph Whipple, born sometime around 1737, was the son of Captain William Whipple Sr. and Mary Cut Whipple from Kittery, Maine. The Whipples raised 5 children, but it was Joseph's brother, General William Whipple, who elevated the family name. William Whipple, Jr., a soldier in the American Revolution and an associate justice of the New Hampshire Superior Court, signed the Declaration of Independence. In addition to all of his political contributions, he was an entrepreneur who ran a mercantile business with his brother Joseph in Portsmouth until the beginning of the Revolution. While the customs collector was an important man in Portsmouth, he would never be as well known or respected as William. He lived in his brother's shadow. The Whipples were not unfamiliar with bound labor, for the family had held Africans in bondage. However, by the 1780s, the Whipples began to emancipate their slaves, in particular those who had fought in the Revolution. Their slave, the famed Prince Whipple, who gave his service to the American troops, was rewarded for his service with freedom. Previously owned by William Whipple, Jr., Prince Whipple's name became well known after he was erroneously labeled as the black soldier in the famous painting of Washington crossing the Delaware. Joseph Whipple was an educated businessman who happened to be friends with Senator Langdon. In August of 1789, following a recommendation from his friend, Washington formally appointed Whipple as Portsmouth's customs collector. Whipple held his position throughout Washington's two terms in office, eventually leaving his post during the Adams administration as his political sentiments became heavily anti-federalist. Whipple found his way back to his post when the Republican Thomas Jefferson became president in 1800. The customs office was small and adjoined the home he made with his wife Hannah Billings of Boston. While it would be more than presumptuous to label Whipple an abolitionist, it was clear that his views on slavery were in line with many of the residents of Portsmouth. With the Whipples having emancipated their own slaves, and with Joseph Whipple rethinking his own Federalist feelings during the last year of Washington's term in office, the request from the president placed Whipple in a difficult position. Although he accepted the assignment from Washington with a professed eagerness and due respect, he planned to investigate the claims about Ona Judge and come to his own conclusions about her escape. Whipple spent the next several weeks searching for the president's fugitive. He would have started his investigation down by the Portsmouth docks, asking ship captains and dock workers, merchant friends and small shopkeepers, if they had seen a young woman with freckles and bushy hair. He would have been discreet, mentioning nothing about her status as a runaway, nor her connection to the president. Like Washington, Whipple came up with subterfuge to lure Judge into his sights. He told his acquaintances that he was looking for a good servant, a woman, who would be able to help his wife Hannah with traditional domestic work, knowing that the grapevine would spread the word. If he were smart, just to be sure, he would have asked free blacks, those who served as maids and waiters to his friends, if they knew of anyone who needed work. Ona Judge learned that the customs collector was in need of a domestic and was immediately intrigued. Friends would have told her about Whipple and his relatively famous family, prompting Judge to remember that this kind of work was something to which she was accustomed. She certainly knew how to serve the rich and famous. The job would most likely be permanent, not a temporary position that always left black domestics vulnerable once their pay was discontinued, with little to no notice. Most important, Judge's friends would have told her that Whipple did not own slaves, another promising attribute about her potential employer. She knew enough after her 3 month stay in Portsmouth that this might be the opportunity she so desperately needed, stable and solid employment. With a mixture of optimism and caution, Judge agreed to meet with Whipple to discuss the position. Never forgetting her fugitive status, Judge was inevitably both reserved and alert, sizing up her potential employer as he asked questions about her cooking and sewing skills. She desperately needed this kind of work, but something seemed off about the customs collector. In fact, he was too nice to her. Whipple began to ask about her personal life. Fair game for any white employer in 18th century Portsmouth. But Whipple appeared to know more about Judge's life than was appropriate. This, after all, was their first meeting. Whipple asked if she had a husband, and then began to ask curious questions about her love life. Odd questions that would make any young woman uncomfortable. The customs collector tried desperately to verify Judge's identity without tipping her off, but he failed. Whipple's charade quickly unraveled once he asked the fugitive about a French suitor. She denied a relationship with anyone, and it dawned on her that she'd been tricked. Readying her feet for a quick departure, Ona Judge grew quiet and waited. The moment she had dreaded was finally in front of her. Judge had been informed upon, and now she stood before one of the president's appointed officials, a white man, wondering how long it would take before she was sent back to slavery. But there was something that soothed her tightly wound nerves. To Judge, Whipple seemed like a nice enough man, that is, he hadn't yet called for the constable to have her arrested. Realizing that he had given away his own intentions, Whipple sensed the fugitive's fear. He had no choice but to come clean with Judge and to convince her that he was an ally, not an enemy. Yes, he had been given a mandate by Washington, but he had his own solution to her dilemma. Rather than tell her what to do, Whipple consulted with her, asked her why she had run away, and discussed possible alternatives to a life of enslavement back in Virginia or elsewhere. During their discussion, the fugitive realized that the customs collector would not use brute force to capture her. Rather, he wanted to talk to her, to reason with her. He gave Judge the courage to speak her mind. Her language shifted from sugary deference to proclamations of righteous indignation. The kind words she offered about the Washingtons toward the beginning of their conversation transformed into declarations of intent. She told Whipple that under no circumstances would she return to slavery, where she could be sold or given to any person. She would rather die than return. At an impasse, Whipple thought that compromise was the only way forward and assured the fugitive that he could negotiate with the president on her behalf. Washington might agree to arrange for Judge's freedom in the future, once he and Mrs. Washington were deceased. This compromise would allow for Judge to return to her family, the relative luxurious condition she had come to know, and end her shadowy life as a fugitive. All she had to do was trust him, a tall order for any black fugitive to contemplate. Judge realized the tables had turned and the customs collector was now negotiating with a fugitive, asking her to listen to his advice and imploring her to travel voluntarily back to Philadelphia. Judge realized that she simply needed to leave. Her resolve was as solid as the granite found throughout the earth in her new state. She told Whipple what he wanted to hear, agreed to return to her owners, and left his presence with no intention of ever keeping her word. Whipple told Judge that he would arrange passage for her on a ship, promising her a smooth transition back to the Washington household and to life as a slave. Judge politely agreed to meet the ship when it was scheduled to depart. She left the customs collector, most likely returning home to her hosts. If the president wanted to claim his fugitive, he would have to do so by force. She would never return to the Washingtons, not if she could help it. Whipple's plan to return the fugitive was delayed, as bad weather prevented ships from leaving Portsmouth. After a few days, the sea settled itself, finally allowing vessels to safely leave port. The customs collector sent word to Judge, giving her a time to meet for her departure and eventual reunion with the Washingtons. It was Whipple's duty to see the fugitive off, so he most likely paced the docks, awaiting her arrival. Repeatedly checking his timepiece, he grew anxious as the minutes turned into hours. Whipple probably convinced himself that there was some kind of miscommunication, perhaps asking the ship's captain to wait a bit longer before leaving port. But then, everything became crystal clear, just as Whipple had lured Ona Judge to his home with a false employment opportunity. She, in turn, sent him on a fool's mission.